told Jonathan he could read that, or if he chose, he could sing it. I don't know if we'd all know the tune. It's probably the most recognizable part of the book of Ecclesiastes. I've mentioned chapter 12 several times. The last few verses of the book being very popular as far as passages in the book of Ecclesiastes. But here we have a passage that even those who don't know much about the Bible, maybe don't know anything about the Bible, they've at least heard a semblance of what is recorded for us there in verses 1 through 8. Before we get into chapter 3 tonight, I want to just remind us a little bit of what we've noticed so far in the book of Ecclesiastes, some things that will help us in our understanding of not just what is written in this book, but why it is written in this book. There are some things that we've seen that we could look at and say, well, you know, that's true. But it's true depending on the way you look at things, the perspective that we have. I have teased some by looking ahead to a passage that we're going to look at and saying that I think there's maybe a better way to look at a passage than maybe the way that we've looked at it in times past. And I think as we go through, we should challenge ourselves to know the reason why these things were written. And not just to take the accepted view, the popular view, what's always been said about a thing. Sometimes things become repeated so much and we just take it at face value that that's the truth and that's the way it is. But when we really stop and think about it from a godly perspective, we might begin to see things just a little bit differently. I think even as people who profess to be Christians, people who are mindful of God, we're here today, we're here this morning, we're here tonight because we have a consciousness of God. But sometimes we can get out in this world and we can be so distracted by the things of this world that we begin to think like worldly people. And I think some of that may be true in regards to some of the things we're going to look at here in chapter 3. One of the things that I want us to see tonight is at the end of chapter 3 and how it relates to something that's very prominent in the news over the last few days, last week. And maybe there's some answers here for us as to why things are happening the way they're happening. And maybe it will offer a solution in how to try to combat the things that are happening. So with that being said, let's get into chapter 3 of the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm not going to reread all that Jonathan read for us, but in that reading, there are 14 pairs. 14 pairs of what we might could describe as negative and positive things that happen in life. So you have in verse 2 a time to be born, a positive, and a time to die, a negative. A time to plant, a positive. A time to pluck what is planted, maybe a negative. But even then, can't you see that it depends on your perspective? I think for the farmer, the time to pluck what is planted may be a more positive time than the time to plant. There's more work involved in planting without an immediate return on that. So even in looking at the list, it might be hard to define what's positive and what's negative. So what is the purpose of these first 8 verses here? Is the writer here, is Solomon trying to tell us, there are all these times, and what we need to do is just figure out what time is it? What time is it for us? What should we be doing? Jesus was very mindful of time while he was here in this world. On several occasions, he would make the observation that a thing would not be done immediately because his hour had not yet come. In Galatians chapter 4 and in verse 4, a passage that maybe we're familiar with, when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law. But But you see, there God was mindful of the time. It wasn't just a time. It wasn't just some time, but it was the fullness of the time. God had a very specific time in mind. And it was obvious through Jesus' life that He had a timetable in mind. That He understood that God was working toward a specific end and everything fit within that. But for us, can we know what the time is? And we might struggle with these verses and just wonder, well, when is it a time to love? And when is it a time to hate? When is it a time for war and a time for peace? And I think what we look at here is a list of things that aren't necessarily prescriptive. That is, a list of things that we're supposed to take and do something with, as much as it is a list of things that are descriptive of this life in which we live. If you look at it in that sense, and you just go through and look at all the things and look around at the world around us, we can see that, yes, all of these things take place. Given enough time, all of these things will happen. And they'll continue to happen. And I think rather than trying to find some purpose for each of these specific things at a particular time in our life, maybe we're just to see that things happen. You remember back in chapter 1, we saw that there's a list here, a describing of things that happen, and there's really nothing that we have control over. Going back to chapter 1 and verse 4, one generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Now, of those things, what do we have control over? Nothing. Verse 5, the sun also rises, the sun goes down, hastens to the place where it goes, the wind goes toward the... Do we have any control over any of those things? And the answer is no, we don't. And for some, that might be frustrating. For some, that might be liberating. We don't have to worry about it. It's going to happen, and we don't have to do much to make that happen. But I think in looking at these first eight verses, if we just study and understand that these things happen, and we don't have control most often of when they happen. Now, there might be a few things there that you say, well, I can control when I love. I can control when I... that. But in a general sense of just looking at the world and the people around us, we can't control those things. And I think that there are some other verses here that help us to see that there's a correlation between what's written here in chapter 3 and what's in chapter 1. Look back in 1 and look at verse 3. Verse 3, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And then he follows with this listing of things that again, we don't have any control over. And then look back in chapter 3 and look at the verse immediately following the list. And so in verse 9, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in His time. Also, He puts eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the works that God does from the beginning to end. But there, verse 9 specifically, what profit has a worker from all the labor in which he labors? And that very much like what's said back there in chapter 1, verse 3. And I want us to see more than just, oh, that's neat. That kind of looks similar. But in looking at what we did in chapter 1 and seeing that all these things happen, and for people in this world who have an ungodly view, that don't have a consciousness of God, and they see this cycle of events, and they just see it as randomness. They just see it as maybe purposefulness. I think I just made up a word. Things that have no purpose, no end to them. And really, that's all it could be. And so, if you look at chapter 3 and verses 1 through 8, for the ungodly person, they would just say, well, that's the way it is. And we... maybe you could try to have some impact on that. The person with the godly view would look at that and really come to the same conclusion. Yeah, that's the way it is. But we understand that there's more to it than just that's the way it is. That there is someone who does have control. There is someone who knows why things are happening the way that they're happening. And it's not just that time and chance happen to all people. That would be the conclusion that one with an ungodly view would take, but one with a consciousness of God understands there's something going on. There's a bigger picture that I can't see, but I recognize is there. And I'm going to trust God in that sense. And thinking about perspective and being able to look at things and see things from the correct perspective, we live in a time when it's becoming more and more common to see drones and pictures and videos that are taken by those drones. And you think about, we live in our bodies that we just see what's around us. But you see a video that a drone takes and you get above the action, and then you can see things that you'd never really seen before from a view that you haven't seen before. And so if we have a consciousness of God and understand that while we can't affect things that are going on and we can't really control when it's going to be a time to be born and a time to die, there is someone who can. And we don't have to see what he sees, but just to understand that he sees it, that he does have a different view. It's a passage in the book of Romans chapter 8 that I know there's been some debate, some controversy surrounding its exact meaning. But I don't think it's difficult for us to understand what Paul is saying. Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. And the thought doesn't stop there. It goes on down, but if you just take verse 28, we know that all things work together for good to those who love God. Now, there might be controversy, there might be debate on the particulars of everything, but it's hard to miss what's said there. All things work together for good. Now, he does not say all things are good. Somebody tragically dies in a car accident, we can't look at that and say, well, that was good, God meant it for good. The thing itself may not be good, but what Paul says is all things work together for good, and not for everybody, but for those who love God. God has a purpose. God can take a thing and make it useful for those who love Him. So as we look at these things that are written there in verses 2 through 8, and we can think, well, we don't have any control over when those things happen, how they're going to happen, who they're going to happen to. No, we don't. But God sees those things, and God can use all of those things in their time for good to those who love Him. And I think that's quite reassuring. As we read on down, in verse 11, He has made everything beautiful in its time. I think that corresponds somewhat to what we read there in Romans chapter 8. But He says He also has put eternity in their hearts. I think that's a very telling verse. And that's a verse we're talking about this morning with the creation and how things produce according to their kind, and how you really don't have to have faith in that statement because the evidence overwhelmingly bears out the truth on that. I think what is said here, that God has put eternity into the hearts of man, I think that's a statement that doesn't take a lot of faith to believe it, because the evidence would overwhelmingly bear that out. You think, well, but atheism, it's growing, and true Christianity, maybe it's dwindling. But when we're talking about eternity in the hearts of man, we're not just comparing atheists and true Christians. If you take all the people of the world who believe in the spiritual realm, who believe in something past this life, and you compare that to atheists, atheists are a very tiny minority in that group of people. The overwhelming majority, and it's not even close, believe that there is something after this life, that there is something to come. Now, what that is may differ from civilization, from culture to culture, but the fact that they look for something else, that's not debatable. And so the evidence is that God has put something within man that has us looking for more, longing for more, believing that there is more. And if you look in Romans chapter 1, what Paul says there is that God has made it evident to us that not just that there's more, but that there is a God who created us And I think I've mentioned this before, but I was in the doctor's office this past week, and you're in there in the office, and they've got these charts of your respiratory system, and they got the charts of your nervous system and the muscular system. You go in there and start looking at those charts, and then start to think that once upon a time we were a rock, and from that rock we developed into this. Well, that's crazy. So along with that consciousness that there is a God, there is a creator, there is also the consciousness of eternity. Now you look at verse 11 and you might think, but there seems to be a contradictory statement. He's put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So is there a conflict in that statement? I think absolutely not. I think he tells us a very important truth that we need to know. We can know that there is a God. Can we know everything about God? Can we answer all the questions that might be asked concerning this God? Where did God come from? That was a question that plagued me when I was a kid. I believed in God, but surely everything has a beginning. What was God's beginning? Well, he didn't have a beginning. He was eternal. That didn't make sense. You know, I wanted some more information about that. But I think that's exactly what this verse is telling us. Except no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. There are a lot of things about God that we don't know, that we're not meant to know, that we can't understand. But the things that we can understand, God has given to us, and we are to take them and put them into practice the best that we can. You think about Solomon, one who described himself in chapter 1, in verse 16, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. Yet this is the one who writes, he's put eternity into their hearts, except no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. Solomon couldn't figure it out. That was one of his great dilemmas. As you read through this book of Ecclesiastes, he's looking for a purpose. He's looking for things in this world that he just can't find any meaningful reason for them, because he was, for that time, looking in the wrong direction, looking with the wrong perspective, looking with that ungodly view, without a consciousness of God. But when you begin to have that consciousness of God and understanding that God is in control and he can do all things and he knows all things, well, that's good for me. And I don't need to figure it all out. I just trust that God will do what is right. In verse 12, so what can we know? If we can't find out the work that God does from beginning to end, what can we know? Well, verse 12, I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It is the gift of God. As we go through the book, that's going to be something that comes up really again and again. This idea of enjoying the things of this life that God has blessed us with. We sometimes, I think, and maybe I'm speaking for myself, but I think this would be true of most everybody here, we may feel guilty at times to enjoy the things of this life. We've been richly blessed here in this area that we live in, this country that we live in. And we can look around the world and see people who are suffering. And there are people who are going without food, yet I drive a vehicle that costs $20,000-$30,000. And I might feel guilty about that. And I'm not saying that we just need to hide our head in the sand and never feel guilty about anything. But one, let's say that we sell that car and we get the money that we can for it, yet we're not going to touch the poverty, the suffering, the oppression that's going on in this world. We're just not going to be able to affect it. And the other thing is, I don't know that God has put us in this world to take care of the world's needs. Now, what he has given us the responsibility for is to take care of the needs that are around us. And as we spoke about this morning, when the need arises and the time comes that we sacrifice to be able to help our brethren, to help those who are in need around us, we need to be willing to do that. But we also need to learn how to rejoice and do good in our lives and eat and drink and enjoy the good of our labor. That's a blessing that God has given us, and we need to learn how to to do that. Some people go through life and they just have no joy at all. They feel like if we're to be holy, if we're to be godly, then we've got to be miserable. And that's not the life that God has given us. You look at Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You know, Jacob describes his life as few and evil. When he meets Pharaoh, few and evil have been the years of my life. But you look at the life of Jacob, he had some good. He was blessed with many children, with many goods. Abraham and Isaac both enjoyed great blessings. And I don't think as we read their story, we see a life that's just filled with misery and poverty and oppression. So we don't need to mistake holiness with poverty or just doing without. We need to learn how to enjoy what God has blessed us with. In verse 14, he says, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which has already been and that which is has already been, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Now, verses 14 and 15 sound a lot like, again, some of the things we saw back in chapter 1. In verse 9, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. The thing that's added here in verses 14 and 15 is that God's behind. It's not just things that happen in life have already happened. God is in control. And nothing can be added to what he does. Nothing can be taken away from it. And it speaks of the fear that we are to have for God, which will come up again at the end of the book. What he says at the end of 15, God requires an account of what is past. You know, that's something that maybe is questionable. Maybe when you're looking around at the things of this life, that might be brought into question, because what's written in verse 16, moreover, I saw under the sun in the place of judgment, in other words, where judgment should have been, or justice, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, where righteousness should be, he says, there's iniquity or wickedness there. And sometimes when we're looking around and we're thinking, well, shouldn't there be some righteousness? Shouldn't there be some justice? And what we see is evil and wickedness and iniquity. We might begin to think that God's not requiring an account of what is past. I think we might be like Habakkuk, who looks around and thinks, God, how long? How long are you going to put up with the sin and the evil that's in this world? Shouldn't there be righteousness and justice being shown? Well, it will be. In verse 17, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. Bringing us back to the thoughts of the beginning of the chapter, God is in control. And all of these things that happen, and maybe to us they seem like they're just, again, time and chance, but God has a plan, and that plan is wonderfully fulfilled. And when we can look back and we look at the events of the Old Testament and the history of man up through that time and how it all converged on the time when Jesus Christ would come into the world, and how it all fit perfectly like this wonderful puzzle that came together and just worked. And we could look at that and just marvel at, that's just unbelievable. And it would be if man were in charge of it. But we weren't. God was. And I'm still, as we read through again and again the scriptures, I'm always amazed at new things that I see and how it fits together with God's plan. And it's just so wonderful. So I need to understand that while things may seem random and while things may seem like it's out of control and evil is prevailing, just never let me forget that God is still in control, and God still will work things out, and God still will judge the wicked along with the righteous. And so don't jump ship. Don't look at the wicked and maybe how they're prospering. Don't look at the way things are going in the world and think, well, I'm just going to join them. If you can't beat them, join them. Well, they're going to be beaten. Don't join them. They will lose. And if you join them, you will too. Again, be mindful of God. He gets to verse 18, and this is a passage that has been abused and maybe misunderstood at the least, abused at the worst by by those in the religious world. The Jehovah's Witnesses have teachings that are taken from this passage concerning the souls of men and of animals. Let's read and see what we can get from this. Verse 18, I said in my heart concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust. All return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animals, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own work, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Now, when we read that passage, we could read it as, well, you know, just absolute truth. The statement that's made in verse 19, surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. We could read that and say, that's in the Bible. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 19, that's what it says. But why does it say it? What's the purpose of the writing? What mindset is it? Well, if we read this and understand, again, this idea of looking at, you know, who's talking, the perspective from which it's being thought, well, from the ungodly perspective, that is, one who has no consciousness of God, one who's not thinking about God, well, that would be true. There would be no advantage for man over the animal. I want to read some excerpts from a couple of books. H.G. Wells he did a lot of things. But among the many things that he did, he was maybe a part-time philosopher. Maybe he was full-time, I don't know. He wrote a book, is contained in several volumes, The Outline of History by H.G. Wells. And when he gets to the 19th century, he talks about how by this time we have figured out. We have figured things out, and science has shown that the 6 days of creation, the Genesis account of creation, it just doesn't fit with the evidence and the history of the things that man has figured out. But it's funny because if you go back to the beginning of the book, in the very first part of it, when he's talking about the history of rocks, he states that we don't know how life began. So in one place, he said, we don't know how life began. Then you come over here and say, well, but we know it wasn't like that. You understand there's some other things that go into why they would say that. But if that's true, if we're just a descendant of the rocks, then what makes man different than animals? Shortly before his death, I think he died in 1946, he wrote in 1945 a series of essays called Mind at the End of Its Tether. And this is a quote from that work. After all the present writer has... I'm sorry, let me read that the way it should be read. After all, the present writer has no compelling argument to convince the reader that he should not be cruel or mean or cowardly. Such things are also in his own makeup in a large measure, but nonetheless, he hates and fights against them with all his strength. He would rather our species end its story in dignity, kindliness, and generosity, and not like drunken cowards in a daze or poisoned rats in a sack. But this is a matter of individual predilection for everyone to decide for himself. And the basis of what he's saying here is there is no God. There's no standard of morals. There's no compelling reason for us to do good or to do right. He says that from his perspective, it'd be better if man would act right, would end its story in dignity, kindness, and generosity. But he says, really, there's no compelling reason for us to do that. Everybody just decides for himself what is best for himself. Now, that begins to get at part of the problems that we see going on in the world today. But this next writer, I think, gets a lot more to the point of why we find ourselves in the place that we do today. Wes Brown, I mentioned that much of what we're looking at here from the book of Ecclesiastes came from a study that we did. He went in Birmingham to UAB, and when he was there in school, the head of the philosophy department was a man named James Rachels. And he wrote a book created from animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism. And I think it was written in 1990. And here's a statement that he makes in that book. Human life will no longer be regarded with the kind of superstitious awe which it is accorded in traditional thought. And the lives of non-humans will no longer be a matter of indifference. This means that human life will, in a sense, be devalued, while the value granted to non-human life will be increased. A revised view of such matters as suicide and euthanasia, as well as a revised view of how we should treat animals, will result. A recreation of morality without thinking of the specialness of human beings is something that he went on to say. Now, that's scary. It's scary to think that you can look at a human life and say, but really, in the grand scheme of it, there's nothing better about you than there is about that dog barking next door. And why do we have any more right to this life and the things of this life than that dog does? Now, here's another man. His name's Peter Singer. He was an Australian philosopher. James Rachels was the editor of a book that included some of Singer's work. And I want to read you a couple of quotes from his works. I've been able to discuss only some of the contributions to this book, saying nothing about, for instance, the essays on killing for furs and for sport, nor have I considered all the detailed questions that need to be asked once we start thinking about other species in the radically different way presented by this book. What, for instance, are we to do about genuine conflicts of interest like rats biting slum children? I'm not sure of the answer, but the essential point is just that we do see this as a conflict of interest, that we recognize that rats have interest too. Now, that's someone who doesn't believe in God, who believes that that rat who bites that child living in poverty has just as much right to that as the child has to not want to be bitten. You know, the rat has a need for food. There's food, and he bites the child. Or maybe he's needing protection, whatever. He goes on to say, maybe we could try leaving rat baits out and we could sterilize the rats instead of killing them. But I would argue, if you want to take that logic, what right do we have to sterilize the rats? Why not sterilize the people so that they don't have more slum children for the rats to bite? You know, if we're all equal, then why do we get to sterilize this group and not the other group? And if I made that argument to him, I imagine that he'd probably shake his head and say, you know, you're right. There's another, this is the last one I'll read. This is from a work that he did called Practical Ethics. And this is probably the scariest of the writings that I looked at. But really, everything else leading up to this says the same thing. This is just drawing the logical conclusion. There's nothing wrong with the logic here. It's just for their starting point where they're wrong. But this is from Practical Ethics. Human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping that they exist over time. They're not persons. But animals are self-aware. And therefore, the life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. And I know you've asked yourself, or you've heard someone ask the question when talking about eagle eggs and why there's such a steep penalty in the United States for destroying an eagle egg, and there's no penalty at all. In fact, the law will uphold the killing of a baby. And we look at that and wonder, how can that possibly be? And the answer is, if you don't believe in God, that is the logical conclusion. The eagle is in danger. There's plenty of people. You kill that baby, there are going to be more people. We're not going to be extinct. But the eagles could be. And so let's protect the eagles and not worry so much about the kids. And if there is no God and we're no different than animals, if what we read here in Ecclesiastes 3:19 is true, that there's no advantage over animals for man, then why not kill the babies? In fact, and I didn't go on to write all that was in here, but In that work, there were some quotes from other people calling for euthanasia, calling for the killing of disabled children, really from a merciful type standpoint, just as we would look at a dog who is suffering in pain, well, let's just put him out of his misery. Why not do that for the child? And the answer is, if there is no God, let's do it. It would be humane. So in the news this week, there obviously you're probably aware of the decision in New York concerning abortion and the late term abortions, and it's just, you know, how could and I've seen a lot of posts from brethren and in others who, you know, maybe not Christians but have an awareness of God who are fighting against that. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't fight or make comments, but I will tell you that we are not going to convince someone who does not believe in God that abortion is wrong. Because in part of some of the things we've looked at here tonight. So to fight on that grounds that, well, this is a baby, it's alive. Well, to them, it doesn't matter if it's alive. They really wouldn't argue so much the fact that it's alive. They just say, well, that, yeah, maybe it's alive, but it's an animal. So what's the solution? What can we do to combat that type of evil in the things of this life? Well, one, I would point back to the first half of the chapter and recognize that God is in control and take comfort in that. I'm not saying that we just accept the evil, that we're not fazed by it. I would remind you of the book of Ezekiel in chapter 9 when God was about to bring about judgment on the city of Jerusalem, and he sends his messenger out, the man with the writer's inkhorn at his side, and I said, I want you to mark all those who cry and sigh over the abominations that are done, and they will be spared, and the rest will be killed. We need to sigh and cry over the abominations that are done. I'm not suggesting that we just turn a blind eye to it. But at the same time, we can also understand that God is in control, and He will judge those who deal so wickedly with the precious life that God has blessed us with in this world. I can also be comforted in the fact, knowing that those children whose lives are ended, however cruel it may be, they're with the Lord. They are His. They're born innocent. If they're not born, they're still innocent. And they will be redeemed. I have no doubt of that. If they're born into this world, I don't know what will happen to them, but I know what will happen in their state if they're killed. Again, that's not a reason for their killing. I'm not suggesting it's a good thing for abortion to take place. But what I'm saying is there are some things that we can look at and think, well, there can at least be some peace about it, maybe. But here's the thing. How can we combat it? Teach people about God. You are not going to convince somebody on Facebook by making post after post after post about the evils of abortion. Is it evil? Absolutely. Should we speak up and say that it's evil? Absolutely. It is murder. And we can say that, but you're not going to change somebody's heart just by... But I tell you how you can change somebody's heart. By taking God's Word. By taking the evidence that we have in this world around us and sitting down with someone and showing them that there is a God. A God that created all of us in His image. And a God that will bring our deeds into judgment at the end of our lives. And if we can prove and show someone that there is a God and they will believe in that, then that's going to take care of these other issues that come along. But that's where we've got to start. Politically, we're not going to change the world. We're not going to change people. Socially, we're not going to do a lot of change just by joining a march or a movement. But if we will accept our task as a child of God to take the gospel to the world, we can change individuals. I don't know that we change the world, but we can change one individual at a time. And so let's do that. So when you look at verses 18 through 22, from that perspective, this is what the ungodly sees. If this world is all that's it, then yeah, that's the truth. In verse 21, who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward, the spirit of the animal which goes downward, and we might think, well, we just never know. Absolutely we know. I know the spirit of a man who goes upward. It's the man who serves his God the very best that he can according to God's will. I know where that soul is going to go. It's going to go upward to God when his life here on earth is over. And I know whose soul is going to go downward. And it's the one who rejects God. The one who rejects the teachings of God. And I can have confidence in that. But that's looking at it with a godly perspective, with an awareness of God. And so let us do that. We read works of people who just don't believe, and we're just appalled by what they write, and we should be. But again, the way that we change it is by finding individuals who have that belief, and let's try to teach them. And let's not be bitter or angry toward them, but have the love and the compassion that God had on us, that he saw fit to send his son into the world to give his life so that we might have a hope of a life after this. Let's extend that hope to others. If you're here tonight, and maybe as we read through, you have that view of you just don't see any good in this life. You don't see any good of serving God. There doesn't seem like there's any justice. Well, begin to think about God. Put God in view and see how that will affect your thinking and your walk with him. And if there's a way that we can help you, maybe there's somebody here who doubts the existence of God. I don't think we should just take it for granted that people who gather together to worship God all have the same confidence in God's existence. But express those doubts. Let us know your questions so that we can deal with them. And so we can help you to see the truth that we serve a mighty God who created this world, who will send his son at some time to destroy this world and all that's in it. But we don't have to worry about that because we will be saved, called up to meet our Lord and be with him forever. And if we can help you in any way to be a part of that, would you come and let us know how we can help you while together we stand and sing.